Well, as you know, the world actually, but more so the United States, has been through quite the change over the past few weeks. We've actually entered a new era of immorality in the United States. We've used the term new norms when situations come along, when there's something brand new that almost takes over society. That new norm was living together without getting married for approximately 15, 20 years. And then, here a few weeks ago, you have a new norm, and that was allowing or accepting, better yet, perversion, the sin of perversion. Now, that's not normal, so actually it shouldn't be called a new norm, but that's the word that they're going to give to it, no doubt. Actually, living together before marriage, at least that was a normal sin. But now, if you understand where I'm coming with that. But this is perversion that is being accepted. When you go to the book of Romans, we can see why a society will come to this place. The book of Romans, chapter 1, verses 18 through 25. There's a reason all this happens. And it has to do with the not just immorality. It goes back farther than that. It started a few years ago, some say in the 50s, some say in the 60s. It's when a society starts believing that there is no God. And so when we come to Romans 1 and verse 18, we see the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Later on in the book of Romans, it says they establish their own righteousness. I think that's in Romans 10. But that righteousness, and sometimes we think, well, you know, it's just they're keeping the commandments, but they're compromising a little bit. When you read in the Bible and the prophecies that they call good evil and evil good, you realize that what they call righteousness is actually unrighteousness. It has nothing whatsoever to do with righteousness. And yet when you read it, it's like, well, they established their own righteousness. They actually went wholesale into immorality, is what Israel did. So we see then they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. And we'll be going into some of those today. Being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So that they really are without excuse. In other words, all mankind is really without excuse when it comes to believing in a God. If they say, we don't believe in God, they're without excuse. When they come up in the second resurrection and they were atheists or they say they're ignorant. Well, we would agree with that, whether there is a God or not. They would be ignorant, but we would say, no, you can't tell me that. You cannot tell me that. And we'll turn to Scripture to show them why they can't tell us that, and they'll have to, over a period of time, admit that they really messed up. But notice it goes on to say, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their own thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Now here we have nothing yet, verses 18 through 23, or 24 or 25 actually, we have nothing where it says they gave themselves over to perversion. It doesn't get into that yet, but the fact is the first step, they say, look, there is no God, or we will determine what we want to worship as God. And it certainly will not be righteousness. As soon as they exchange the truth for a lie, now they get into the way of perversion. They don't before that. What is it? Leviticus 18:5 that tells you a lot about not being perverse, gives the statutes and judgments of God. Now, for this sermon today, I almost called it Fun with Fools, but I decided not to. And the reason is, if we were out there, we were in this world, the same thing would happen. But you know, you really can't help but mock some of the things that come out, and we'll see some of the verbiage of learned men. They are learned men. They're scientific, and they are smart. They're educated. They really are. They're intelligent. Some of them are probably geniuses. And yet, when it comes to the subject of God, their minds have been darkened. And they do come over as fools. God does call them fools. But I decided not to do that because we could have been there, although there will be some mocking. Elijah couldn't help but do it, and God didn't bring fire down from heaven on him. But you can't help but mock some of their ridiculous theories and conclusions, because they really are ridiculous. So I called it God is real, involved in our lives. God is real, and he's involved in our life. If we just left here knowing what we already know, and that is, these men are really foolish, that wouldn't help us a bit. What we have to do is take a look and see how the real God is so involved in our personal life. The sermonette reminded me of a conversation I had not too long ago where the person was talking about his employer. And I was thinking there, because he was really hurt. You could see this. Well, you know, he's really going to, when I'm gone, he's really going to feel bad. He's going to be, wish that I was back. And I said, well, you know, maybe fasted about this. Yeah, I fasted. Well, maybe and I did appreciate the sermonette. I thought it was right down the line, because all of us need something like that. And I think I'll have Mr. Smith talk to this other young man who maybe help him out a little bit. But the point is, when we fast, guess where the finger goes? When we fast, if I, you know, that employer of mine or that other member, you know, who's giving me problems, the finger is always supposed to come here. You know, it says, stop pointing the finger, and it comes back to us. And so when we fast, we do just as Mr. Smith was talking about. We take a look at ourselves. Maybe something I can do, not to change people, although they might be nicer, but we can't depend on that in this world. But still, in this world, how do you change a fool? How do you change somebody that's an evolutionist? Last night I was going through, looking for some of the ridiculous statements that are out there, and I came across a guy who used a Lego set to show how you go from inorganic to organic. And he was from England, and he was using the term evolution, E-V-I-L, is how the way he was pronouncing it. And I thought, that's good. That's the way he should be pronouncing it. Instead of evolution, it should be evil-lution. But whatever the case, his little program was ridiculous too. Here in Psalm 14, 1 through 3, Psalm 14, verses 1 through 3, we see a statement. In fact, we have sung this song. I can't remember whether it's in our present songbook. We've had a few over the years, but it is one I believe that was a hymn by Dwight Armstrong. This is Psalm 14. And here it says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, their works are vile, is what the song went on to say. You remember the song. They are corrupt, they have done abominable works, there is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if any understand, if any seek God. They've all turned aside, they've become corrupt altogether, there's none who does good, no, not one. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and do not call on the Lord. There they are in great fear, for God is with the generation of the righteous. So here's a song that we've sung for several years, and it gets the point across. But the reason they say there's no God, The third line in my Bible on this psalm is, they are corrupt. They are corrupt. Anytime one begins disobeying God, they can feel guilty and repent, or they can justify their actions, or they can say, well, maybe there isn't any God. Especially if other people sin against them, hurt them, and you're in the church, and they're in the church, and they have hurt you badly, and you just can't get over it. So what we do is we could come to that decision. We have a really good friend years ago who became an atheist. And for some reason, he just got hurt, but he had other problems too. He started sinning. And he didn't repent. It can happen to any of us. If you've never had hurt feelings, you are unusual. Very unusual. I've had hurt feelings, definitely, and you wonder, when those people are going to change? But none of us can let those feelings get the best of us. But we don't want to come to the point that we are corrupt ourselves, do we? Because that's going to send us in the wrong direction, where we're going to have a lot of problems. We will be shamed. There is no God. What do they say then, if there is no God? What do they say about where matter comes from, or how life began? So here's what I came up, and it's very fast to find this type of thing, because believe it or not, most people out there are evolutionists. On the web, at least. It's just really hard to find people who are intelligent design promoters. Even in some of these sites where I thought they're really good sites concerning the marvelous workings of the human body, you'd think that they would be intelligent. This means they are creationists. And even they will twist things. And they will say that, some say that the eye, we'll take a look at that after a while. Some say the eye is really complex. But, you take a look at it from an evolutionist standpoint of view and it's simple. Well, this had to happen, and then this happened, and then that happened, and you look at this, and it's like, that's simple. Anybody can fool themselves about anything. Deception is our greatest problem as human beings. Deceitful above all things, and then we become desperately wicked. So here's, maybe Mars seeded Earth's lives, the article. Followed up by, maybe it didn't, which is really neat. Maybe the Martians did. Mars seeded Earth's life. So this is 2013, a fairly recent article by Caleb Scharf. And we're asking, what do these people who say there's no God, what do they say about where life came from? The new argument, in a nutshell, is that young Mars had a more oxygen-rich atmosphere than Earth did 4 billion years ago and was drier. There was a note left on Mars, and when we finally sent a probe by there, the little note kind of sifted up, that's evolution anyway, sifted up into the probe and got close enough to the camera that was going by Mars at least so we could take a picture of it and said, well, we know you're coming by 4 billion years from when I'm writing this note, and oxygen levels are high here and it's very dry. you wonder about these things. So this would have resulted in a different mineralogical surface environment, one that could have provided a catalyst for the assembly of key RNA molecules. Now, I'll point out to our young people who are inundated with evolution theory in school, and I don't know if homeschooling does the same thing. I suppose if you go to the right source, you're not going to get this type of thing in homeschools. But you get this could have... Maybe, perhaps, all the time. Could have provided a catalyst to the assembly of key RNA molecules and all the biotic chemistry leading to life as we know it. Subsequent asteroid impacts on Mars would have spewed chunks of rock into space carrying life, presumably in microbial form. Well, I would suppose so. If it's dead, it's sure not going to seed life. Through the solar system and onto the surface of a youthful Earth. Now, that's nice. So this man is really sharp. By the way, kids and adults, these men come across with highfalutin words, words that you may have to look up in the dictionary, because, and they're proper words. They're not improper words. They are scientific words, but they sure are applied wrongly. They're not defining something that they, that should be defined. Here's another one. Could Martian bacteria have seeded Earth? It's a new study of an ancient meteorite yields new clues to the origins of life. And this is by Jeffrey Kluger, October 2012. So also not too old an article. If you were a passenger aboard the meteorite from Mars bearing down on the town of Tata, Morocco in July 2011, you would be in a decidedly unenviable position, especially, I guess so, if we were, we would die. But if you were a bacterium, let's say, one thing, you'd be a bacterium. On the other hand, maybe you'd survive, maybe the shock would not have been so great, or you'd be tucked away deep enough in the meteorite that you were spared its full power. And if you did survive and arrived on Earth, a few billion years ago, maybe you'd have adapted well to your new home. I don't think so. They just told us in this previous article that Mars had a different environment. It had more oxygen, and it had, more water? Oh, it was drier. So why would you have something now adapting to Earth 4 billion years ago, which had more oxygen and was drier? It would die right away. It'd be like us going into a desert that was 200 degrees. We go from our home environment to an environment. It's going to be better? The answer is. So can you help but mock some of these things? Now, as I speak, it's important for our kids to take every word, every sentence of these evolutionists and analyze the sentence. Put it all together and start thinking. Because once you think these things out, there's no way that they can go ahead and fool you. All you have to do is once they start talking and they're using organic matter, that is living matter, all you have to do is go back one step. Well, how did it get to be organic? Well, it was lightning. We're going to see that. It was lightning, primordial soup, they call it. And you have this lightning flash. Not that it would have to be that way. This is just an idea, they come out and say. I am not kidding you when you read this stuff. But it's so erudite, so scholarly, so professor-like. Well, 4.5 billion years ago, we had a collaterum of sophistication, racketeering. We don't want racketeering, but that's actually what we're doing as evolutionists. Sorry about that. They make you think that they're so bright. So now the question is, where did you get the inorganic matter? Well, it was just there. No, you're saying there's no God. There can't be anything. There can't be nothing. And nothing at all. So you have a panspermia that hits the earth. That's the word they're using. You know, seeding the earth. Okay, we go to a guy named Andrew Knoll. He's a paleontologist and a professor of biology. He actually has written the book, Life on a Young Planet, the first 3 billion years of life. And He asked certain questions, how deeply living things on our planet are intertwined, and why it is so devilishly difficult to figure out how life got started. He asked that question. So this is where he's going now, and we'll come to what he concludes. How life got started. So he says it's pretty clear that all organisms living today, even the simplest ones, are removed about 4 billion years from the initial life form that they had. And then he said, but they must have had a fundamental property of being able to grow and reproduce and be subject to Darwinian evolution. Now, why is that? Because he's an evolutionist, so they must have had the properties to develop. So he goes on to say, so it might be that the earliest things that actually fit that definition were little strands of nucleic acids. Maybe. Why would he say that? Because it takes nucleic acids to get DNA. So he says we can't have DNA, but he has to start with something that he knows must have been there to bring us to the point where we are right now, knowing what's in a cell. Then he says, but something that could catalyze some chemical reaction, something that had the blueprint for its own reproduction. Now, we built a house 10 years ago, and I failed to recognize that all I had to do was put a blank piece of paper out on the lawn and wait, because the blueprint would have been there. I would not have had to do anything. Of course, I'd be 4 billion years old right now. But isn't that amazing that it's there and it had the blueprint in it already to reproduce? Now, where do you come up with that? Now, this is a guy who probably has made a few hundred thousand dollars on his book, The First 3 Billion Years of Life. I don't mean to advertise it, but that's it. So he goes on to say, would it be something we would recognize under a microscope as living, or would it be totally different? That's a good question. Then he says, I can imagine a time when there was no life on Earth, and then I can imagine a time when there was, X hundreds million years later, life on Earth. That is so deep, brethren. That is just really good. I can imagine when I didn't have a foot, but I was walking around on stubs. Then I can imagine a time a million years later. This is more possible, actually, than what they're doing, where everybody had feet. But it actually gets more ridiculous than that. So then he says, and here's some words, and I'm almost at the end. Then some of them, well, he says, the next paragraph, I can imagine that on a primordial earth you would have replicating molecules. Then some of them start interacting together, and pretty soon, there's a dance coming up, you know, all of you molecules, let's all get together at the town hall. In other words, how did all of these molecules get together? They just have them getting together. But they were separate, so you had to have different evolutionary starts also to have all of this take place. Some of them start interacting together, why didn't the others start interacting together? They weren't, it's a life of the fittest, you know. And pretty soon you have something a little bit more lifelike, and then it incorporates maybe another piece of nucleic acid from somewhere else. And by the accumulation, the wind's blowing. Where'd the wind come from? By the accumulation of these disparate strands of information and activity, something that you and I would look at and agree that's biological would have emerged. In a nutshell, what is the process? How does life form? And then he says, the short answer is, we don't know. And he's getting paid to say this, by the way. I think I'll start writing information like this. Any of us could do this. Okay, well, let's go on with Psalm 19:1. Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. This is Psalm 19:1. There is no speech nor knowledge where their voice is not heard. Now, we've sung that song too, but if you stop and think of what this is saying, it just means God is not speaking in any actual language. He's not speaking French. He's not speaking English or Arab. What he's saying is that the language that you can see concerning his creation is there for everybody, and they all should be, they should all actually be convicted to the core of their being that there is a God that exists. That's what it's saying. There is no tongue, no speech, where their voice is not heard. And that's what verse 3 means. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Everybody should know. In Isaiah 40, so we'll take a look at some of these things that individuals should know. But Isaiah 40, and if there's any chapter to know about, I wouldn't say that we're going to memorize Isaiah 40. But when we go to Isaiah 40, God tells us how great He is compared to the earth, and how little people understand and comprehend God Himself. But when you go through Isaiah 40, and we should do this from time to time, anytime we think that we are anybody, that we are something, it's always good to get down on our knees, humble ourselves, and take a look at what God, at the difference between God and man. Now, I might mention in going through Isaiah 40, God is not putting any of us down. When He says that we are less than nothing, He's not saying, look, I'm great, you're absolutely nothing, you never will be nothing, and that's it. He's not saying that one bit. He is telling us, though, how great He is. And the lesson for us is that we are worshiping a very, very powerful God. And by Him telling us how powerful we are, comparatively to Him, we see that He can do anything. Absolutely anything. So we start here, verses 12 through 18. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of His hand, that is, all the waters in the earth? To God, all the waters on the earth, by the way, I read another report where it said that the earth and all the oceans, all the water on the earth came from outer space. It was an asteroid ice chunk that hit the earth. Now, if it hits the earth, what's going to happen? Have you seen how hot those things get coming down? Well, they're going to melt on their way. Maybe that's what happened. It melted in the atmosphere and it rained. That's what happened. But the explosion, if you have anything left, the explosion is going to melt the whole thing. It's going to evaporate. Well, it's actually dissipates. Well, maybe it'll evaporate and go into space. I don't know. Is it going to stay on the earth if it hits? Maybe it will. Boiling water comes back down. So maybe they've got that one covered. Who knows? What do I know? Measured the heavens with a span. Calculated the dust of the earth in a measure. Now, are the heavens huge, powerful? And they are. It's just saying God is more powerful. Weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as His counselor has taught Him? He never comes away after I pray and then goes to the angels or Christ at His right hand side and says, you know, I just got done talking to Greg Sargent. I really learned something. I didn't know this until I was talking to him. That never happens, brethren. Never does. We can never say, well, God does not know what He's doing. It is just completely, totally impossible. It just doesn't happen that way. God knows everything and has the power to do anything He wants to do anytime. Verse 14, with whom did He take counsel and who instructed Him? Who taught Him in the path of justice? Who taught Him knowledge? Showed Him the way of understanding? Then, verse 15, behold, the nations are a drop in the bucket and are counted as a small dust in the balance. Notice verse 17. All the nations before Him are as nothing, and they are counted by Him less than nothing and worthless. So when Christ returns and all the nations turn, you know, at Armageddon, all the nations with all of their arsenal, more technologically advanced than they are right now, turn on God, is God going to say, oh no, look at all these hydrogen weapons pointed at me, I better turn around and go home? Or do we go back to Isaiah 40 and we say, God says, well, look at that little drop in the bucket. That's all, that's what God looks at. Look at that little drop in the bucket. You might want to keep your finger here. I'm reminded, is it Psalm 2? Well, we used to sing this psalm all the time. Years ago, Psalm 2, in God's attitude, I really get a kick out of this psalm. It says, why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? And that's what they'll be doing at the end time. The kings of the earth set themselves, Psalm 2. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed one, saying, let's break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords. So that's what they say about what they're going to do to God and his anointed one. You know, we have all this power now. We turn on God. You know, we're going to be friends now. We're attacking each other. And then they all turn on God. He who sits in the heavens just laughs. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I've set my king on my holy hill of Zion. This would be Christ is going to rule over the earth. So you can see God's attitude, and it's like, what are these human beings doing? They can't, don't they know they can't touch me? And the answer is, they don't know. They don't know how little power they have. After all, we've seen all the movies. We see that we on earth can, you know, defend ourselves against these wicked aliens that are coming to earth. I don't see those movies, but if I had grandkids close by, I'd probably see some of them. I'd be taking them to the movies because they're very popular. And I think it's good guys, bad guys is what it is, always. And I hope the good guys are really good and the bad guys are really bad in the movies. Otherwise, you know, we distort our kids' minds. But here, back to Isaiah 40. Isaiah 40, verse 21. Haven't you known? Haven't you heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Haven't you understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are just like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a curtain, and he spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princes to nothing, and he makes the judges of the earth useless. Verse 25, to whom will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes. See who's created these things, who brings out their host by number and calls them all by name. You know, it used to be that there was only, what, 1 million galaxies, and now there's 100 million galaxies. And you take all the stars, all the planets, and God says, oh, you want me to name them? And then he'll start naming them, just like that. And we have some of the same names that you see in the Bible. Some of the same names. So God has given them names, and how many of us can actually, how many of us can memorize Isaiah 40? Given enough time, I think we could. But how many of us can remember 100 sons, 100 million sons? So what's good about all of this, brethren, is that when we call on God, we know that we have a mighty God. Notice, I'll just mention, in Matthew 6, God clothes us. He said, he is the one who clothes us. Now, the God who can do all that is said in Isaiah 40, can he come to our rescue? Can he clothe us? Can he give us what we need anytime? Can he give us favor in our boss's eyes? We had another lady come to me after church, and they're honing in on her because of the Sabbath. And she says, you know, my boss, not a very nice person. And I believe her, some of the things that she told me. I said, well, you know, pray that God would give you favor in the eyes of your boss. That can happen. But if he doesn't want you on the job, if he doesn't want you there, then you'll just get another job. She's a young lady. And that can happen. But God can do all these things because he is a very personal God. He's so big, so mighty, so majestic, and yet he comes down to our level. In Matthew 10, he talks about the hairs on our head are all numbered. The hairs on our head. In other words, when we lose, you know, you take a shower and you look down and maybe there's a couple strands of hair in the shower. You hope that they will regrow. But they're there. And God said that was, how many hairs do we have? 500,002. Less than some. My brother came, and I'm trying to put some type of sprinkler system in myself, because you know what they charge to pay for those things? So anyway, I'll do it myself, and then I'll make all the mistakes, and then I'll have them come in. That's what they do. But he was there, and so now we tapped into the meter on the proper side, I might add. And my wife took pictures. And we were down in this hole that was literally 3.5 feet deep. That's how far they buried the 1-inch line there, copper line. And I looked at some of these pictures, and I said, that had to be Steve. And Marion's, she warned me in advance. This was my head, the back of my head, and it was coming right down here. It was the wrong angle. Couldn't have been the right angle. But I saw skin. Now, it used to be that I saw all hair. I could never see skin at all. Some of you are going to look. I know. Actually, one woman down in Wichita came up to me when I first went down there, and she said, my dad and I have a bet. We think you have a wig, one of us. Well, it's not a wig for a man, toupee. So I said, yeah, I do. And then I grabbed my hair. And said, well, I don't, but I may have to in the future. Although if I had a head like Mr. Crystal, you know, he has a nice shaped head. So Yul Brynner and Mr. Crystal both had a nice shaped head, so they can get away with it. But anyway, the point in all of this is God is really close by. He's very personal. He really is very personal. My wife doesn't know how many hairs I have on my head, and yet we are very close. We are best of friends. So what about God? Is he a best friend? And the answer is yeah. God is very, very close to us with all this power. Job 37, verses 3 through 5. We'll go there. I don't think I went there this morning in the sermon. Right before the book of Psalms, or right before the Psalms. It's actually not a book. These are Psalms. But Job 37, 3 through 5. And then, of course, we understand what's going on here, where Elihu is talking, and he believes that Job is being disciplined by God. But he says, verse 3, he sends forth this rumbling unto the whole earth, his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it, a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice. He does not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. He does great things which we cannot comprehend. God does great things that we cannot comprehend. So we went with some general statements about God in Isaiah. If you ever looked into lightning, because it says his lightning he sends to the ends of the earth, the astronauts have looked down and they've said that the earth at night, you can see just a chain of lightning where it seems to start in one spot and this moves 1,000 miles. It just kind of one sets off the other. And he said, it is amazing to see this, and I believe he was the one, or maybe he was the one who looked at what the astronauts were saying. I forget the actual name of the fellow who was in the documentary. But he said, lightning is something else, and especially what it does. If we didn't have lightning, we wouldn't have fertilizer on this earth, and we wouldn't have that fertilizer in our bodies. And I'll tell you what he meant by that. We have lightning because you have water and ice crystals, and then you have electric currents up there that tear apart the nitrogen that is in the air. And when that nitrogen is split, it's like a vacuum. It's looking for something to attach to. And it attaches to oxygen. There's plenty of oxygen around. So there's not only H2O, there's also nitrogen and oxygen. I don't know the exact, you know, numbers that you would put to nitrogen or nitrogen oxide, but it becomes a nitrate. And a nitrate then is there, and the rain picks it up. It, like any dirt, is attached to rain. Rain is pretty clean, but still has elements in it. But one of the elements would be nitrates. Falls on the earth, goes into the soil, then the plant picks it up through the soil, picks it up. We're being evolutionary now. It just happened. gets into the plant, we eat the plant, then we get the nitrates. Now, every living organism needs nitrates. It's a basic nutrient, really, for the whole body. If we didn't have it, we would die. So, when did evolution figure that one out? There was nitrates, and then there was lightning, or there was lightning, and then there were nitrates? Well, there was lightning and nothing grew because there were no nitrates, so nothing could grow, but then there were nitrates. I mean, how do you do this? Which was first, the chicken or the egg? So you start looking at these things, and they wouldn't be able to answer these questions at all. And by the way, there's 13,000 tons of nitrate placed on this earth every single day. 13,000 tons. Lightning strikes. There are 40 strikes per second. There's 3 million lightning strikes per day. And very few people are killed by lightning. Very few people. Which also is a blessing from God, because all those lightning strikes you would think would kill a lot of people. 3 million lightning strikes. You don't even hear of 1,000 people killed in a day. It just doesn't happen. It's very few in the United States. The expression that we have, again, is less chance to be struck by lightning, right? And even when you're struck, Lee Trevino was struck 8 times, was it, out golfing? He's the professional golfer of years ago, carrying an umbrella, and they get struck. So you see some of the details of what God has done. How did evolution do that? And this powerful God can come to our aid. When you go to the cell, this is the amazing world inside a cell. It says, this is Elisa Michalik and Emily Carlson from the National Institutes of Health who wrote this, June 29th, 2011. She said, as you read these words, electricity is zinging through your brain. And by the way, the eye is looked upon as the second most complex organ in the body, and the brain is the most complex. So as you look at these words, electricity is zinging through your brain. Voracious killers are coursing through your veins, and corrosive chemicals bubble from your head to your toes. That doesn't sound very good, does it? In fact, your entire body is like an electrical company, chemical factory, transportation grid, communication network, detoxification facility, hospital, and battlefield all rolled into one. The workers that drive these activities are your cells. It says that one cell can be doing thousands of routine jobs all at once, all at the same time. You'd think that that's really small. So what this lady did was take us down to 3 millionths of our normal size. And she said at that point we'd become smaller than dust mites, which you can't see, of course, smaller than a strand of hair. And when you get into a cell and you're that not so tall, then basically you'll see the nuclei of the, or the nucleus actually, of the cell, and it's 50 feet wide. The actual cell would look about a football field in length. And so the cell would be about 10% of the nucleus would be about 10% of the cell's interior. And it goes on to say that it contains genetic material, DNA, which all of us have heard of, which guides the making of billions of proteins, molecules that participate in nearly every cellular process. Billions of proteins. By the way, there is a good article in Discern magazine by Martin Cole, I believe his name was, a science teacher, on why he does not believe in evolution. You can go to the latest Discern magazine and read that out, or check it out. Then it goes on to say that encasing the cell is a membrane with special gates, channels, pumps. You have pumps actually in the cell. Now you're this real little guy inside a cell, and you see these pumps going on that let in or force out selected molecules. It's choosing. Some they let in, some they don't. The membrane protects the cell's internal environment. A thick brew called the cytosol, made of salts, nutrients, and proteins, that account for about half the cell's volume. And then it talks about other proteins and lipids, fats. The cells of humans have more. And as I read this, your brain starts kind of Do I have to remember this all on a test for your science teacher? We were talking about this, and I was going through some with my wife, and it's like, this is just amazing. And it's like, this is supposed to be amazing and not comprehensive. It's something you have to study. You know, sit down, study, look up the words, know what they mean to understand the function going on. But some of what's going on we can't imagine, because you get into the billions. What's $1 billion? It's just 1/9 of what Trump has, right? $1 billion is what that is. So anyway, next to the nucleus are interconnected sacs called endoplasmic reticulum, or ER. And from your shrunken view, because you're really small, each sac is only a few inches across, but they can extend up to 100 feet or more, and they're rough or smooth. This ER sends newly made sends proteins and lipids to the Golgi complex. Remember that? Students, that's going to be on the test. G-O-L-G-I. Do some of these teachers study this the night before so they can get it down? I think I would have to. But anyway, it says the Golgi complex processes these proteins and fats and sends the molecules to their final destination inside or outside the cell. This printer is going on. They duplicate, they reproduce in these cells what is needed. You know, they used to think that in our brain, if we had a glass of wine, there would be certain amount of cells that were destroyed, that they would never come back. If that were the case, there would be a lot of alcoholics who would be going around without any brains at all. But they found, actually, they do regenerate. You know, you can destroy cells, and then the body reproduces brain cells. Going on here, it talks about the mitochondria, and I'll end on this one, that convert energy from our food into ATP production. If you're an athlete, you know about ATP because you know that you need that for heart function, for energy, so that you can go out and run farther than a half mile, you know, or a mile, or 2 miles, or a marathon. ATP production, they call it. And it says, if you're there, you have about the size of a pickup truck. The organelles call these mitochondria, converting energy from your food into the ATP. So if you don't eat the right food, this is why you don't have enough energy. And many other reasons too, of course, in this society. But if we don't eat the right food, you have very low ATP production. What is amazing on this, and then I'll leave the site, a typical cell burns through 1 billion molecules of ATP every month. The answer is no, every day. And the answer is no, every 1 to 2 minutes. 1 billion molecules of this ATP, which we need for energy, every 1 to 2 minutes. This is just amazing. And, of course, this is just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, when it comes to the miracles in our body. Now, this is God who's making these things. And by the way, I think it was Bernard Longhibler who sent me that lightning article, didn't you? If you may have sent it to a few people, but if you want it, then he'd be glad to send it to you, because it's a small, short, 5 minutes, but it is an amazing article. When it comes to the eye, this would be the last example I use, but you have a source that is actually evolutionist, and it's picking on the subject of the eye. And so it goes through the complexity of the eye, how intelligent designers say that the eye is vastly complex, and that Darwin would have had a problem with it. But now they're saying, no, Darwin would not have had a problem with it. And as you go here through all of this, it says, one likely chain of development in the eye is that the eyes originated as simple passages of photoreceptor cells. There we go. Well, that's good. It originated as simple patches of photoreceptor cells. If you build a camera and you put an inorganic matter down, and you watch it, and you watch it, and you watch it, you're going to die 1,000 deaths and nothing's going to happen. It's not going to originate into anything. There's not going to be any. You're never going to get a camera out of this thing, because this is what they're really talking about. This turns into a camera, your eyeball. And they've got this, oh, now that's simple, isn't it? You know this old story about the earth, about the evolutionist and and God who are talking, and the evolutionist says, well, let's start both with dirt, and I will show you I can build a man just as well as you can. So God says, okay, and so they start, and the guy says, well, where's my dirt? You remember the story, and God says, make your own. Well, with this, the evolutionist starts with what here? A photoreceptor cell. A simple patch. And God would say to this guy, now you create your own photoreceptor cell and go from there and make your eyeball. And I'll make mine. And we'll see who's the fastest. See if that's another story. Anyway, when by random mutation, they don't use the word by, they use via, that makes them sound really, really smart. When via random mutation across the population, the photosensitive cells happened to have developed on a small depression, it endowed. An endowment is what you give to a college, so they have whatever. An endowment is something you can bank on because it's in the bank there. So it endowed the organism. So the organism is there, and when the organism wanted this thing, there it was. There's that photoreceptor in a small reception. And now the organism comes along and says, oh, there's my future eyeball. Let me grab it and put it somewhere on my body. So it just goes on with all of this, and the language is the same all the way through. Did inorganic matter become organic living matter? There's one thing I'd like to, we're going to end with two scriptures here, but how did organic matter assemble itself into life? This guy says, primordial soup. He says, and the lightning is the current theory. He said, assemble the base elements, wherever you get them, in a water environment, wherever you get that, and hit it. Who's hitting it? You know, it's like, hit it. Give me a hammer. Where'd I get the hammer? Who? Hit it with a spark. Hit it with a spark. Hit it and it makes a spark. It just says, hit it with a spark. Now we have a torch here, you know, with a spark. Now you've got something else, a file with metal, and you hit it with a spark. And you can make the specific chains of proteins, which make up life, through DNA. Just because it's possible, though, does not mean it had to happen that way. Being possible does not constitute proof, unlike creation, which must have a God to even be possible. So what do you start with? Would you rather start with God or with what these guys are starting with, which is nothing? Okay, let's go to Isaiah 26 and verse 3 to end the sermon. Isaiah 26 and verse 3. There's so much more that you can go to. But again, the whole sermon is to show us really how powerful God is. If we believed in evolution, you can see how miserable and hopeless we would be. It would be, who would you call out to for help? Would there ever be a miracle? And the answer is there couldn't be a miracle. There is no God. Anyone to depend on that is powerful spirit being that comes to your aid in all the times of need? The answer would never be. We're dying on a deathbed, and what is our hope? As my dad said, what is life all about? What is life all about? And he died knowing maybe that there's hope because anytime he came to town, he wanted to come and hear the sermons that I gave. As soon as he died, my mom didn't want to come and hear my sermons. She liked me, but not as much as Dad wanted to know about life. But notice in Isaiah 26, when we have a God that we depend on, here's what can happen. Verse 3, Isaiah 26, You will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on you. Because we have this great God. And when our mind is stayed on, that means we meditate on God, we read this verse, but Job, where I didn't go, Job 38 is a good place to go, Isaiah 40. When we read these things, and brethren, I do. I wake up with anxiety, I wake up with, I need help, I need encouragement, and I will go over to these verses. You know, I'll go to Isaiah 40 a few times a year. I'll go to the Psalms. Because I need that. All of us need it. We just do. Because we need to be renewed day by day. That's what we need. Every single one of us. Whose mind is stayed on him because he trusts in you. So he will come to our aid because we have a mind that is looking to him, and we will have peace. Peace of mind. If ever you wake up in the morning and you don't have peace of mind, start meditating on God's way and what God is doing in your life. And that he's in control and that he'll make things turn out all right. We have to do our part, but he will make things turn out peacefully. And we can have peace over that. So I hope that helps us. As I said, I need encouragement from just these scriptures, and knowing that God is there as a personal God on my side is very powerful. I know all of us do. So let's all be encouraged that we do not believe in evolution, that we have a powerful God who comes to our aid.